All right, welcome back. This is part two of the Gary Kvistad podcast, episode number 10 of the Concert Honesty podcast. In this episode part, I get a tour of Gary's studio and I get a little history and some context behind some of the instruments that he has collected over his lifetime. It's a fascinating little trip down memory lane for him, but also just history. He's a historian and he loves collecting items from the past. Anyway, I think you'll enjoy it. It's a really great sonic tour. I have to apologize. I'm getting used to this new Zoom recorder, so some of the sound peeks out a little bit. Some of his instruments are incredibly loud, like deafening. They're like carnival instruments that are meant to be played in like three-ring circuses and stuff, or being drugged down a street behind a political campaign truck or something. Anyway, enjoy. This is part two, Gary Kvistad's studio tour. All right, thanks. Bye.
And believe it or not, it was fair. So, yeah, this is I call this the Vista phone, V-I-S-T-A. Mm-hmm. My last name is Kvistad, and believe it or not, it was fairly recently that I realized the interior letters of my name was Vista. So it's a Vista with a K in the front and a D on the end. And students, when I was using this in workshops, they would call this the Kvistaphone. And I thought, you know, that's going to, what does that mean? So Vistaphone sounds like it's important or something.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's the 32 partials based on this primary note of a G.
Okay.
And that's the note that Harry Parch used for his system was a G, so that's what I use. But the beauty of this is that, you know, when a string vibrates, it's vibrating in a lot of different modes simultaneously, and they're harmonics on a string, which means that they're low number ratios. The way they relate to each other are very simple and pure.
Yeah.
Whereas a tam-tam, which is this huge thing, defining note, there's like hundreds of partials to that, and they're not necessarily harmonic because they're very complex, and that's the beauty of it. It's a kind of a noise generator, a beautiful noise.
Right.
This then is, since percussion instruments in their raw state are not based on harmonics, they're non-harmonic in many cases, I wanted to hear what the notes of the harmonic series were. Because you can't play them on the piano. The piano's tuned to a modern system called equal temperament, and it's every note except for the octaves are slightly out of tune, some more than others. So
to
I want
to allow you to play in every key.
Right, so you can modulate from key to key. So, and some people say, you know, I like E flat better, it does this to me, and I like A flat, and I don't notice the difference other than the what's called the tessitura or the tightness of the sound or the timbre. So I wanted to hear what individually what the harmonic series sounded like. So I built this instruments of large tube, medium tubes, up to really small rods, and so you can actually hear it. And when you play it, the number of the tube indicates actually the relationship to each other, to this one. So this is number one. Mm-hmm. This is number two. Number two is vibrating twice as fast as number one. Number three is vibrating three times as fast as number one, and four, and all the way up to 32. This one's vibrating 32 times faster than this thing. And this thing is vibrating at 100 some vibrations per second. I don't remember the exact octave it's in. So anyway, what's really neat about this is that there's something called difference tones. So when two notes are played together, the difference of their frequency is heard in our ear, which reinforces this harmony part of it. And when they're tuned in this pure of a system, any two adjacent notes, like say number four and number five, the difference is one. So it's vibrating this fundamental note in your ear, not in the air. So it doesn't show up on any equipment at all, except for our equipment, which is unique, human equipment. So let me play these 32 notes for you.
Thank you.
last for quite a while.
There's a point when you got about like somewhere in here where like I sort of had to move my head. Like it wasn't painful. It was just a, like my head's it's going to vibrate off my neck. If I don't move this way a little bit.
Well, you notice I only hit each one of these once.
That's right.
But this kept getting louder and louder because of that reinforcement. Now, I'm not going to hit this one again. I'll play the other ones and this one will get louder and louder. Listen to that. Still going. There's sympathetic vibration too, which it kind of makes it vibrate in the air more because it's got the same frequencies happening against it, but that difference tone element and phenomena is really very profound.
Amazing.
All right.
Holy smokes. Yeah, let's move on.
Moving.
I just want to sit with that sound. What are the differences between these three gongs, first of all? What are they called? Are they called a specific name in?
They are, and I can't remember the Balinese names for it, but the difference is that the large ones here are kind of the bass note, and they always come in a pair for the larger ensembles. One's female and one's male. The lower one is the female, the upper one's the male, and they actually are at the end of each section. We kind of hear it at the beginning of a section, but they hear it as the final note. And this one, which is smaller, is the next gong, and then there's an even smaller one, a third one. So in Balinese music, in the ensembles, they use the three gongs plus the doubling of the large one. I think all these gongs are actually made in Java. Uh-huh. That's where the gong specialists are, but they're kind of tuned and adapted in Bali. So in Java, the gongs, which are the ones with a button in the middle and they have a very specific pitch to them, in Bali, they like to have a lot of movement in the sound. Mm-hmm. In Java, it's really pure. It goes bong. And in Bali, they hammer it so that they get two pitches beating against each other. Mm-hmm. So it goes bong, 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 bong. Oh. And it goes throughout their ensembles. There's a pair of instruments that are detuned at the same amount that a soprano would have a vibrato, like 7 cents. So like la, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So when the two notes are played in unison, you hear a vibrato. Mm-hmm. If you just hear one, it's just kind of still.
Right.
So it adds to the character of the music. Gong Kebyar is that style of music out of Bali that's really energetic. It's like the big band music of Bali. It's really cool. But there's a lot of activity as far as even the sound of the instrument alone.
Well, let's hear one of these.
All right. Yeah. Well, here's the instrument I said was my favorite. It just is so beautifully coupled, the resonance and the pitch. It sounds like this. It's a 25% flat from an A flat, but that's the beauty of it is that to them it's perfect. It's not flat.
Right.
It's
right.
The note they want.
Right.
And here's a D2, and it's also about 30 some percent flat. Now here's the A. The stand is a little noisy, but. You get to hear the resonances are incredible.
That's amazing.
And so I have a whole bunch of other gongs. This one's from Thailand, the Thai gong, which is a different sound, but a really beautiful sound. And then there's a lot of Chinese gongs, and I have some from Korea. They're all beautiful.
Awesome.
My wife's favorite instrument, though, you asked me,
uh-huh.
is the hang, H-A-N-G,
mm-hmm.
the Swiss instruments.
Yep.
So years ago, my physics teacher told me about this couple that were making these things, and he did a study. He did analyzed how they were the spectrum of sound of these things, and so got to know them. So I bought two of them early on to my specs. I wanted to hear the specific scale, and they stopped making them many years ago, to the dismay of a lot of people, because they're very, very popular, because it's sort of like a drum circle. Anybody can play these things, you know, to get a sound out of it. So
well, they're sort of like a hand played steel drum.
Yeah. Right, right.
And, yeah, I got to come clean. As a steel drummer.
Yeah, it's cheating, right?
The guys
it's like
SOA
training
make,
wheels.
The guys in SOA make fun of me all the time. I have an irrational hatred of the Hong drum. It's not rational. I don't actually genuinely dislike the instrument. Just it
but
always.
You resent them.
Well, okay, yeah, maybe there's a little resent. It's just like, why don't they get to play wrong notes? Why isn't there a wrong note on the Hong drum? I got to play a fully chromatic instrument and have the possibility of hitting a wrong note. But it's
well, there's only a wrong note if there's a right note. You know, I mean, sort of like the reason you could play any note on a steel drum and there's no wrong notes there, but if it's a specific tune that's an E flat and you're playing a non-scale note. Maybe that's a wrong note.
There's a wrong note if Steve Mackey writes a C sharp and you
right.
play a D.
Exactly.
You're definitely
that's
wrong.
A wrong note.
Well, what are we going to check out next?
All right. I have some, in the next room, I have some antique percussion instruments.
Let's go
see
check
dog.
That out.
So, yeah, this is I call this the Vista phone, V-I-S-T-A. Mm-hmm. My last name is Kvistad, and believe it or not, it was fairly recently that I realized the interior letters of my name was Vista. So it's a Vista with a K in the front and a D on the end. And students, when I was using this in workshops, they would call this the Kvistaphone. And I thought, you know, that's going to be, what does that mean? So Vistaphone sounds like it's important or something.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's the 32 partials based on this primary note of a G.
Okay.
And that's the note that Harry Partch used for his system was a G, so that's what I use. But the beauty of this is that, you know, when a string vibrates, it's vibrating in a lot of different modes simultaneously, and they're harmonics on a string, which means that they're low number ratios. The way they relate to each other are very simple and pure.
Yeah.
Whereas a tam-tam, which is this huge thing, defining note, there's like hundreds of partials to that, and they're not necessarily harmonic because they're very complex, and that's the beauty of it. It's a kind of a noise generator, a beautiful noise.
Right.
This then is, since percussion instruments in their raw state are not based on harmonics, they're non-harmonic in many cases, I wanted to hear what the notes of the harmonic series were. Because you can't play them on the piano. The piano's tuned to a modern system called equal temperament, and it's every note except for the octaves are slightly out of tune, some more than others. So
to
I want
to allow you to play in every key.
Right, so you can modulate from key to key. So, and some people say, you know, I like E flat better, it does this to me, and I like A flat, and I don't notice the difference other than the what's called the tessitura or the tightness of the sound or the timbre. So I wanted to hear what the harmonic series sounded like. So I built this instruments of large tube, medium tubes, up to really small rods, and so you can actually hear it. And when you play it, the number of the tube indicates actually the relationship to each other, to this one. So this is number one. This is number two. Number two is vibrating twice as fast as number one. Number three is vibrating three times as fast as number one. And four, and all the way up to 32. This one's vibrating 32 times faster than this thing. And this thing is vibrating at 100 some vibrations per second. I don't remember the exact octave it's in. So anyway, what's really neat about this is that there's something called difference tones. So when two notes are played together, the difference of their frequency is heard in our ear, which reinforces this harmony part of it. And when they're tuned in this pure of a system, any two adjacent notes, like say number four and number five, the difference is one. So it's vibrating this fundamental note in your ear, not in the air. So it doesn't show up on any equipment at all, except for our equipment, which is unique, Whoa. Human equipment. So let me play these 32 notes for you.
Vibrate off my neck if I don't move this way a little bit.
Well, you notice I only hit each one of these once.
That's right.
But this kept getting louder and louder because of that reinforcement of the. Now I'm not going to hit this one again. I'll play the other ones, and this one will get louder and louder. Listen to that. Vibration too, which it kind of makes it vibrate in the air more because it's got the same frequencies happening against it, but that difference tone element and phenomena is really very profound. That's I
amazing.
Think
amazing.
All right,
holy smokes, yeah, let's move on.
Moving.
I just want to sit with that sound.
Stuff that you probably have too, like round top glockenspiel and an old artist special xylophone. And a couple with plastic heads, but old timpani. This is a nabimba.
A what?
A nabimba.
Nabimba.
Which, you know, J.C. Deegan built a lot of instruments back in the late 1800s. He was a clarinet player in the Chicago Symphony, and mm-hmm. he was really irritated by the way the glockenspiel sounded. It was out of tune, so he tuned it up, and then he standardized the tuning fork to A440 mm-hmm. internationally. That was his thing.
Deegan did that?
Yeah.
So he's the one who standardized the tuning fork.
Well, he pushed for it, and he got the government to standardize it, and so it kind of became universal. But he made a lot of instruments, and this is a nabimba. I'm sorry, it's not actually playable because the caps are off, uh-huh. but it goes down to the low cello C, like uh-huh. the new 5-octave instruments too, yeah. that we all use.
Yeah.
But back then, this is like unheard of. This is probably built in 1915 or so. And it was used in the Mustard Marimba bands, you know, as a bass instrument. But what's unique about this, there's two things. It was carved on the top and the bottom. He thought that yeah. uniform carving made it better. I'm not sure. But the resonators, they weren't closed on the bottom. They had a membrane on the bottom, so they buzzed like a Mexican instrument.
Chiapas marimba.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep. Yeah. Those things in Guatemalan
yeah.
style. So.
And were you supposed to play these on the edges, or were you supposed to play them in the middle, or did it not matter?
It probably didn't matter.
I'd be afraid.
I'm not sure what the performance practice was back then.
I'd be afraid to break one just because they're so thin in the middle.
Yeah, no, this is the only non-original bar. I had to carve this one because the previous owner had lost this bar.
Mm.
I'm not going to mention the fact that it was my brother, but. Let me see. Actually, I have some mallets already. At least you can hear the buzzing sound of the mallets. Let me see which one of these, a couple of them have.
What's the
it's like the intestine. It's supposed to be the intestine of a lamb or something like that. Mm-hmm. And you go to the butcher shop and they'll give you. They use it for sausage casing. But I went high tech and I use plastic shopping bags. I cut them up. And I'm a vegetarian, so I just couldn't use a membrane.
That's okay. awesome.
And what's interesting about this instrument is that when Nexus was recording, long before I was in the group, and I knew these guys well, playing with Bob and Russ with Steve, is that they were going to do some ragtime music recording. They were going to do Spanish Waltz, which is a George Hamilton Green tune. Mm-hmm. And they borrowed this instrument. This instrument's on that tune. John's playing the bass line on this thing,
awesome.
Which makes it really unique again.
Yeah, that's cool.
So Deegan, besides making this stuff, they also made a lot of novelty instruments for vaudeville, uh-huh. including shaker chimes, which is what these things are. And they're kind of based on the angklung instruments of Indonesia, mm-hmm. Which are made out of bamboo. These are made out of metal, and they're really an incredibly unique sound. Some tunes on that thing. And it's a transposing instrument. It's in the key of B flat, which is so weird. But
do you have to, like, read trumpet music when you
right, I guess. But yeah, like I said, those were used in vaudeville, and that they made sets that were like really huge. I think maybe as much as 5 octaves all the way down to just an octave. This is I think a 2 octave set, 2.5 octaves, and they're very pretty rare actually.
Yeah, I've never seen them.
Now, this, Deegan made tuned sleigh bells. This was made by another company, but it's exactly the same sleigh bells that Deegan used. Mm-hmm. So these are even more rare, I think. So you could play. Amazing. Like, yeah. We thought we were doing weird stuff, right? These guys were doing this in the 20s.
Yeah. Amazing. I mean, just to make one of those now would be prohibitively expensive, right? Just like if you were just going to get the leather, like the leather, beautiful leather straps.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Insanely expensive.
And then you'd have to, you know, tune each bell by carving here or here.
Yeah. A lot of work. Great.
So I actually have, did you know Dean Drummond and New Band?
Mm-mm. I mean, I know the name, but yeah. I don't know personally.
Well, he was a good friend of mine. He actually wrote a couple pieces for, that Black Earth did.
Okay.
But he was Harry Parch's assistant for many years. So he was totally expert in microtonality and all that. So when he moved to New York area, he started a group called New Band and wrote a lot of music for it. And they did some Parch music, but he built these instruments that I have here. Dean passed away a couple years ago at a pretty young age, in his 60s, so very sad. But I'm just holding this for Stephanie Sterin, his wife, who played in New Band, also a flute player. But it's a metallophone, mm-hmm. Made of tubes, and tuned to the Parch system. So I'll play the notes by dampening the other one. So that was 1 octave I just played. System of 43. 43 tones to the octave so he could play all 43 all the time. It wasn't serial music, but rather so he can pick and choose the exact maybe five notes only or four notes that he wanted to play, rather than being restricted to the four notes in an octave of the piano that he wanted. So, and like, for instance, this is that, let me see if I could figure this out. This is that scale of Olympus that I was so intrigued by when I first read about it. We think of the black notes on the piano, which are very major sounding, but that's like an incredible scale, and that is in just intonation, what you just heard.
Well, and when you play, I think when you play like a perfect fifth or a fourth or a third, like sympathetic harmonies or open harmonies on a piano, we've been trained to think that that's actually what it is, but a pure major third. Can you play a major third on here so folks can hear exactly what a third actually sounds like?
And the relationship is the upper notes vibrating five times for every four times of the lower one. So it's coming together really often.
It's like it's essentially a really fast rhythm that's happening, a 5/4.
Yes.
Happening at a high rate of speed.
And you're hearing that difference tone. You hear the buzzing in your head? Mm-hmm. That you don't hear that on the piano.
Yeah.
The beating that you're hearing is an individual tube, because unless it were perfectly round, you're going to get some beating because it's slightly oval. Mm-hmm. So one place on the tube is a little higher than the other one, mm-hmm. But when you the real pure intervals are there. While we're here,
yeah,
this is the instrument I built.
And this is the instrument for the Lou Harrison Pete. It's called what?
Solo.
What's the instrument called? Do you have a name?
Oh, the instrument. We call them Lou's tubes.
L-O-O-S-E or L-O-U apostrophe S?
Yeah, apostrophe S.
Okay.
Loose, not loose tubes.
Loose tubes.
That would be good. But Lou very specifically said it needs to be in just in tone D major,
okay,
and gives the notes, but it's pentatonic scale. And I have resonators tuned to the same note. So, and they're closed on the bottom, so the resonators are only really resonating the fundamental, which is what I really want.
Oh, wow.
So, this is that's that D major pentatonic.
Yeah.
The very beginning.
Those pipes that you built me for Dan Truman's piece, I think I need to build the resonators now.
That will change it.
It's the next step.
Amazing change. Should I play just a couple measures
so
you can hear what this sounds like? Here's just the opening. Thank you. pretty sound, isn't it?
Yeah. And what is it? And this, it's a solo.
Yeah. When I did it with Nexus, I there's three drone notes in this thing, so I had the drone notes separate. Normally, you would just play it and somehow let it ring, but they're all ringing. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, I had two of the guys in Nexus play the drones out in the audience to give it some antiphonal effect. So it's sort of like, here's the drone note. Set up here is I'm memorizing it.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to remove the music stand, and we're going to do a video of this thing from a lot of different angles and see what that looks like.
Awesome. When's that coming out?
Well, you know, like at my age, memorizing takes a lot longer, so there's no deadline. We'll see.
Good, good. You've earned the right to not have to put a deadline on yourself, you know.
You know, unfortunately, I have CRS, which happens when you get older.
What's CRS?
Can't remember shit. Just get used to it. It's going to happen.
Which number is that?
Yeah, right.
You reeled me in like a
Yeah, bitch. That's over 50 because okay, it has a bad word in it.
How many people have, like, how many people own roles like what you have? Of the Kanwa Nankara stuff.
You know the, Nankara?
Yeah.
Not very many at all. I mean, I had a hard time. Laura Kuhn owned one mm-hmm. that Charles Amerkanian had given her of the Canon number 21.
Was it an
Canon
original
X.
role?
No.
It was a reproduction.
A reproduction, yeah. I don't know where the originals are. I think son's still alive.
And the ones you have are reproductions of?
They're, yeah, cut in Germany by some guy. It took me like... months to track him down and find out that somebody actually has rolls. So of the about 60 rolls, I think, that Nankaro created, this guy has 35, and so I bought a copy of all of each one of those. And I've set up a little, what I call the player gallery.
Uh-huh.
Which has mechanical musical instruments. And this is the Regina music box you were just talking about. So, and this is, I think, from the late 1800s. Slapstick in there. So and pre these this thing is sort of in working condition, but these are called barrel organs, and this one's the Chautauqua barrel organ, and this one has a name too, but a lot of these rolls that and like that music box, it, a lot of religious music was written for it or adapted, and I think probably because like churches in rural areas that couldn't afford an organ or something, they would have one of these. And so this is but obviously that wasn't a religious tune, but Then I have other music boxes, more modern by Rouge, and a lot of 78 Edison players, and a cylinder roll. Probably shouldn't play this one because it's kind of racist. It's let me put a different one out for you. But back then, I guess it was acceptable to some circles.
So what's the roll you're putting on now?
It says...
And these are sort of like LPs, except they're like they look like little canisters.
Yeah, yeah, they're called cylinders. What is the actual name?
But the concept is the same. There's a needle going over a groove.
Right, and this is the first player, like recording player that Edison made. I keep wanting to say cylinder seals, but that's something else. That's ancient Egyptian stuff. This is a, I guess, cylinder phonograph. So here's... I'll play it in the middle of it somewhere. I think I need a new needle or something. A lot of Irish music, I guess, awesome. Too, huh? Here we go.
The cylinder's incredibly fragile, too, right?
Yeah. Like, they say you get 100 plays on it.
Is that right?
And then they just... So that one, I think, is probably on its 110th play. This is that instrument.
This is the chime instrument that you made.
I call it the indoor carillon.
The indoor carillon.
And you know the piece, right? It's a...
Is it from the prelude from the G major?
C major, yeah.
Yeah, okay. C major.
The next word. Let's start over again.
A five.
Take two. So this one, I broke up the bass notes to the large tubes here. So it plays. We need three players to play this one.
Awesome.
So that's the indoor carillon. And it goes all the way around to every chord. These are the upper notes. You can hear the tonality. Crazy thing, but we actually videotaped it, and someday I'll edit that because we did this like 15 years ago,
yeah.
With Thad Wheeler and Mark Stewart played in that concert.
Mark's great.
Yeah,
I wish more people could hang with him. He's
a genius.
He's
man.
Brilliant. I mean, he's Paul Simon's band leader, but also like he could just be that and be a genius. But he's also like an instrument builder. He makes weird stuff. And
Bang on a can, all star.
Yeah, he's the. Well, the first time I met Mark, he was playing what he calls the thrombadu.
Yeah.
And we were doing a kiddie show for, it was at the Bang on a Can Marathon, and we were playing for outdoors for families, and it was a family event. So we were doing a lot of, like, fun, weird stuff with percussion. And he's like, now the next instrument I'm going to play is thrombadu. Can everybody say thrombadu? And all the kids are like, thrombadu. And he's like, now it's kind of a mix between a trombone and it's like if a trombone was a hermaphrodite. Do you all know what a... Can everybody say hermaphrodite?
And
all the kids are like, hermaphrodite! And the four of us are like, what is that? And Mark just... And he just had them eating out of the palm of his hand. It was so good. Yeah.
I know. He's incredible. A funny guy, too. So this is a player piano, which plays honky-tonk music. This is a good one, too. But it... plays one dynamic level, just kind of loud, basically. Uh-huh. And it's made for, like, dance halls and bars.
Mm-hmm.
And here's what it here's, and it's mostly popular music, but they also record a lot of classical stuff too. But let me turn this on for you. Wasn't that a party? And it's high energy and really fun stuff.
Yeah.
They came up with this instrument called the reproducing piano, which is a player also, but it can reproduce dynamic levels. I think 8 levels, something like that. So with holes punched in it, it tells it how loud to play any note.
When did that development or improvement in the player piano happen?
Shit, I wonder. I need to look that one up. But a lot of these Rachmaninoff recorded. I have 30 rolls of Rachmaninoff playing his own music.
Wow. When was the player piano invented, do you know?
I think most of the stuff was in its prime in the late 1800s and then kind of died in the late 20s when radio and records came out, and then the Great Depression hit. People couldn't afford it anymore. Yeah. So like the 30s, they weren't making them anymore. This piano was made in 1926. It's a Mason and Hamlin with an Ampico B player unit. And once again, it plays whatever rolls you have. I have over 1,000 rolls for this instrument.
And what rolls in there right now?
It's I think a pop dance music or something. Yeah, foxtrots. And it tells you what speed to set it at. So this is 80. Tasty stuff, man.
Beautiful.
You can see where really it's got expression now.
Yeah.
To it. And like I said, I have Copeland playing one of his tunes. I have Debussy playing on a roll. And I have 35 rolls of the music of Conlon and Carroll.
You have a roll with Debussy playing his own music.
Yeah. Or is it Ravel? Let me take
a
look.
It doesn't matter to me. Would it be amazing?
One of those two guys. Yeah?
Can we hear one?
Yeah, if I could put my hands on it right away.
Stardust. I'd love for folks to hear that, and I'd love for folks to hear a just a little bit of a non-girl one, just to hear.
Oh yeah.
How insane that stuff is.
Yeah, let me find this one, which he was. Supposedly said he can't stand playing it anymore. He played it so many times. Biggest request.
This is a Prelude in C sharp minor, Opus 3, number 2, by Rachmaninoff. Played by Rachmaninoff.
Oops. On a reproducing piano. Let me get this together for you. I also have Rachmaninoff playing the Star Spangled Banner, which is like an incredibly beautiful arrangement.
Wow. Well, I don't watch that doesn't
look that
hot.
Yeah, that's good. So I set this for 90. Here we go.
Thank you.
that's an acoustic recording. I mean, I play it on an acoustic instrument.
Uh-huh.
You know, it is a recording. Yeah. It's always the same every time, but at least you can hear it without electronics. So I'm sorry I can't find that one.
That's okay. No, this is great.
We could play some Nan Carol.
Yeah, let's hear some Nan Carol, and then we can check out the rest of the stuff, and I will let you go, because it is Father's Day.
Yeah, well, both of my kids are in Florida, and Diane's down there, too.
Why'd you stay here? Just
I had that gig last night.
Oh, the gig. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Scott Joplin playing one of his rags. This is actually Scott Joplin playing. And a lot of modern interpretations of Scott Joplin's music is really fast and uh-huh. kind of shows off his incredible technique. Well, he actually played his rags kind of slowly. Oh. This one starts off really slow and then just gets into a nice groove.
Okay.
But you set this kind of at the bottom of the speed wheel. It's called Magnetic Rag. This is around the time Edison was recording stuff that he did this. Sample. Isn't that cool? So
that's amazing. So how so they would, so that's Scott Joplin playing, but yep. how was it transferred recorded? To the role? How was it recorded?
And they have, you know, just like modern technology with soundboards and all that, they had equipment machines actually marked where this note was played, I believe. Mm. I need to research this a little bit more. They added the dynamics later with the performer.
Got it.
Somebody was keeping notes as to what was loud and soft, and it was a very complicated process.
Whoa.
So then they made a master roll, and then they made copies from that with machines. So number 36, this is study number 36 of Conlon Nankeros, which...
And who's Conlon Nankeros, just in case people have no idea who he is?
Well, he was an American that was blacklisted way back when, so he moved to Mexico City.
Why was he blacklisted?
He's a member of the Communist Party and totally upfront with it. And then he was participating in the Spanish-American War,
uh-huh.
which was considered a traitor. So he left the country and for some reason started doing these roles, man. I don't know how he made a living because I don't think he sold these things. A lot of composers, Kyle Gann is a real expert at this. And mm-hmm. Kyle's on the faculty of Bard College, as you probably know. Who was it that he was really good friends with? One of the European composer who said that Nan Carroll was probably the most creative and cutting edge composer of the 19th century, mm-hmm. 20th century, that is, sorry, mm-hmm. 1900s. Because what he focused on was temporal relationships. So there might be like 2, 3, 4, 5 voices at different tempi, mm-hmm. and that's like really impossible as a human being to play that exactly. I mean, it's one thing for us as percussionists to play 7/4 or whatever. I mean, this is a whole melody line playing at a certain tempo that's really exactly a certain relationship, a difficult one, or maybe 5 of them, and it's all over the piano and really fast arpeggios and stuff like that. So
yeah, and the lines are crossing all the time.
Yeah,
so you'd be switching hands if you were trying to do a live, which is also another.
Well, if you'd have to have 20 hands to do some of these things.
And on
more.
A piece of paper, you can punch a hole anywhere.
Right. That's what he did for these things. He, unlike the other one, he didn't play and record. He actually had a machine and he punched the holes by hand. But he wrote the music first. It's all written out.
Yeah.
And then he realized it on the roll. So what we're about to hear is a performance as he intended it to be, not a recording whatsoever.
Okay.
So it's the same mechanism, an Ampico B player, reproducing player. And with an acoustic on an acoustic piano, and at the tempo that he set, which is like opposite here
of Scott Joplin.
Of Scott Joplin. Study number 36.
It's really beautiful to watch the roll go by.
Yeah, because it's like a graphic music or something, right?
Yeah,
like
it's, I mean, you see, people are doing this now, and like, you know, in their laptops, like they make these crazy pictures on, you know, in Logic or GarageBand or whatever program they're using. But it's like to see it, an analog version of that is really, really striking.
And this is the how computer programming came about.
Punch cards and stuff.
It's zero and ones,
yeah.
Like it's off or on.
Right.
So that hole, when it goes on the paper, goes over the hole on the tracker bar, it activates a key.
There's air coming through that, right?
This suction, yeah. And then right here on each side of the roll are the dynamics.
Yeah.
Here's like one. So that tells it how loud to play that particular note. Which is beautiful. Nancarrow wasn't into like using that a lot to crescendo. He mostly did terraced dynamics, so the whole section was really loud and really soft or something. He stepped it up or down, but it was there and available.
So cool.
Yeah, I think these are pretty rare. I mean, first of all, in order to use these rolls, you have to have a player piano like this, an Ampico, because he wrote for Ampico piano, reproducing piano. And then you have to have the rolls, of course, which are even more rare. And then you might have one or two rolls. But so I've collected the 35, and I'm probably the only person that has it. Kyle Gann has a Yamaha digital piano, and he has them all played digitally. But I love the mechanical part of this. You know,
and hearing the sort of the soft white noise of the paper going over the like it's like, you know, it's listening to a record. You hear the contact, the friction of the needle on the record. It's awesome.
So you want to hear a little George Hamilton Green on this thing?
Yes. So what is this instrument?
This is a Wurlitzer military band.
Okay.
It's made up of about 100 organ pipes.
Okay.
That sound like saxophones and reed instruments, and then a whole bunch of trumpets in the front, an oboe bank and a piccolo bank, a bass drum, a snare drum, and a cymbal. And I have, I don't know, maybe 40 rolls for this thing, and each roll has 8 to 10 tunes on them. They're pretty big rolls. And one of the rolls I just happened to have had a tune on by George Hamilton Green, Fluffy Ruffles.
Yep.
And it's a piece that Nexus plays.
Yeah.
We actually took this to Birdcliff for a concert many years ago and played Fluffy Ruffles along with it.
Oh, wow.
Of course, Bill had to rearrange it because it's in a different key. And those guys were very nice to do that because that was not easy. You know, they memorized this piece, and then all of a sudden you have to play in a different key. It's really different. So here's a little bit of Fluffy Ruffles by George Hamilton Green on the band organ, once I learn how to turn it on. So I guess one last instrument. We have time.
Yeah, let's do it.
This is the Unifone.
Uh-huh.
Deegan made this. Also a vaudeville error instrument. This one needs a little bit of work, but it's played by a keyboard. It's basically a mini octave glockenspiel.
Mm-hmm.
And if you press a note, you get a sound. And if you press it all the way down, you get the octave. And it's really loud because they put this on the back of like a pickup, Ford pickup, like a Model T.
Uh-huh.
And they'd go through town and it would hook up to the battery. And they would advertise films in the 20s or teens or political rallies or something like that. So you might want to step back.
Yeah.
Bill Kahn, my associate at Nexus, calls this the doorbellophone.
That's awesome, Gary. I really appreciate you giving me the...
Well, you can tell I've enjoyed this.
Yeah, yeah. It's the nickel and dime tour of your fun house here. Well, man, I really appreciate your time, and I'll let you get back to your life. But is there a place that people should go to, like, if they want to know more about you and your instruments and your company and your music work?
Well, our company website is chimes.com. Mm-hmm. We got in early, as you could tell.
Yep, yeah.
And or nexuspercussion.com.
NEXUS
percussion. Mm-hmm. Also, I did that TED talk, so you can Google my name and TEDx.
Okay.
And see that. That's 13 minutes. I had to memorize 13 minutes of rap. That was amazing. And on that, I play a little bit of Steve's piano phase on instruments that I built. Mm-hmm. You've heard it before. But I did it with a loop station, so because I didn't have anybody else on stage with me, so that was interesting. But that's kind of my whole business, from fourth grade up to the present time in a nutshell.
Amazing. All right. Well, thanks a ton, Gary. I really, really appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks for listening. I hope you had a good time with Gary. He's a real hoot. He's also one of my favorite people on the planet. And if I could just hang at his place once a month, I think I would be a very happy person. His vibe is so good, so generous, he's a super smart dude. So it was fun to sit and chat with him. It was a real honor also to get to play alongside him and his colleagues in Nexus, Bill Kahn, Russ Hartenberger, and Bob Becker. Those guys are our heroes, and it was a pleasure to be in the room with them. And anyway, I could talk for days about Gary. He's a lovely person, so I hope you all get a chance to meet or work with him at some point. I'm sitting down on Thursday with Paul Lansky, so I'll be sure to get that out as soon as possible. Paul has been a longtime collaborator of So Percussions since 2006, I think, when he wrote Threads, which sort of spread like wildfire through the percussion quartet repertoire world. Small though it may be, Paul's piece really reached a pretty wide swath of the percussion community. So we have Paul to thank for that. And he was sort of at the tip of the spear for a lot of the early technological and innovations. Almost all of the stuff that you use inside your laptop that makes music, Paul had some sort of some contribution to it. He was either there in the room when it was happening or was using some of that technology when it was on punch cards on pieces of paper, where he'd have to let something sit overnight for 8 hours to print out like 13 seconds of music or something crazy like that. So I hope you'll enjoy that conversation too. I'm really looking forward to it. All right. I'm going to leave you today with a recording of a piece by Dean Drummond, who founded a group called New Band, which is new to me, but I know of Harry Partch, though I've never actually played any of Partch's music. I knew of him through my percussion studies. So it was interesting to hear this piece and get to learn a bit more about Dean, who Gary mentioned as being one of his friends who passed away, who worked with Partch and built some of the instruments that we listen to today. So anyway, this piece is called Congressional Record. It's by Dean Drummond, and it's played by New Band. All right. Thanks again, everybody. We'll talk to you soon.
I first reported to the Senate some evidence that a war was then being waged against America's standards of decency by some self-proclaimed artists funded by the National Endowment for the Arts. Tried in vain to persuade the American people that such so-called art deserved the taxpayers' money allocated to the arrogant artists whose minds belong in the sewer. Self-proclaimed artists consist of a wide range of curious individuals who have no regard for decency. Dead men and women to produce stomach-churning photographs from burning the American flag to flouting their own bodies and those of others. Such depravity knows no bounds. This bill finally alleviates the burden shouldered by the American taxpayers of allocating money every year to an agency whose mission has been sorely mistreated. The strings will be cut. And the government will no longer be in the business of propping up a group of people who are in a lifelong crusade to destroy the Judeo-Christian foundations of this country. National Endowment for the Arts Termination Act, of 1997, placed in the Senate, calendar number 8, 105th Congress, first session, section 48, a bill to abolish the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Council on the Arts. In the Senate of the United States, January 21st, 1997, Mr. Helms introduced the following bill, which was read twice and placed on the calendar. National Endowment for the Arts and the National Council on the Arts, be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled. Section 1, short title. This act may be cited as the National Endowment for the Arts Termination Act of 1997. Section 2, termination of the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Council on the Arts. Sections 5, 5A, and 6 of the National Foundation for the Arts and the Humanities Act of 1965 are repealed. Section 3, conforming amendments. A. Declaration of Purpose. Section 2 of the National Foundation on the Arts and the Humanities Act of 1965 is amended. 1. In paragraphs 1 and 6, by striking arts and the 3 in paragraph 4, by striking the arts and 4 in paragraph 5A, by striking by the arts and B, by striking arts and 5 in paragraph 7A, by striking practice of the art and the B, by striking artists or and C, by striking creative. Touched her breasts with his hands and mouth. He unzipped his pants and exposed himself, and she performed oral sex. He stopped before he ejaculated. He was talking about performing oral sex. He was chewing on a cigar, and then he had the cigar in his hand. He was kind of looking at the cigar in sort of a naughty way. And so I looked at the cigar and I said, we can do that too. It tastes good. I first became aware of the problem our national plumbing laws have created when I began to receive complaints from a variety of frustrated individuals. Discontented consumers, plumbers, remodelers, landlords, home builders, and others were upset their new expensive toilets were repeatedly clogging and consistently required fountain mouth flushes. The message is clear and often written on toilet paper. Out of my bathroom! If some consumers want tiny toilets or trickling shower heads, the economy will produce these products. Now is the time to heed the call. Suffering Americans. Pass the Plumbing Standards Improvement Act of 1999 and restore wisdom to our federal government.
Thank you.